Taking a look at figure 28, we have a magnetic variation chart and a time conversion table. This figure is used for questions regarding when an aircraft departs an airport in a specific time zone at a specific time for a flight of a certain duration. What time will it arrive at either its new time zone, or what coordinated universal time would it arrive? The way you figure out every question that pertains to this figure is the same. You convert the time the aircraft departs to the time that the question is asking. For example, an aircraft departs the Central Standard Time Zone at 09:30 Central Standard Time for a 2-hour flight to an airport located in the Mountain Time Zone. What time is it in the Mountain Time Zone when this aircraft departs the Central Time Zone? It's 1 hour less. So, if the airplane departs the airport in the Central Time Zone at 09:30, it's 08:30 Mountain Time. Okay, so it's 8:30, it's a 2-hour flight, the airplane arrives at 10:30 Mountain Standard Time. The other type of question they ask is, at what coordinated universal time will the airplane land? And that is even easier, because you just take the departure time, you convert it to UTC, and then you just add the hours of the flight. For example, an aircraft departs an airport in the Central Standard Time Zone at 08:45 Central Standard Time for a 2-hour flight to an airport located in the Mountain Standard Time Zone. Well, it doesn't matter where the airport is located, because the questions ask the landing should be at what coordinated universal time. So if it's 8:45 Central Standard Time, what time is it coordinated universal time? You look at the map and it says CST, Central Standard Time, you add 6 hours. So if it's 08:45 Central Standard Time, you simply add 6 hours. So it's 14:45 UTC when the aircraft departs, and it's a 2-hour flight. The aircraft lands 2 hours later at 16:45. And that's what all the questions are like on figure 28. Let's move on to figure 29. Let's take a look at figure 29, illustration number 8. The VOR receiver has the indications shown. What radial is the aircraft crossing? Well, that's another way of saying, what radial is the aircraft on? Illustration 8, showing an OBS set to 210, needle is centered with a 2 indication. What radial are we on? We are on the 030 radial. That happens to be one of the answer choices. Let's take a look at another one. Let's look at illustration 3. The VOR receiver has the indications shown. What is the aircraft's position relative to the station? Notice illustration 3, there is no to-from indication. It's telling you either the aircraft is right over the center of the VOR, or it is on a radial that is perpendicular to the radial indicated. The answer choices are east, southeast, or west. Well, none of those choices are aircraft over the station. They want to know, what is the aircraft's... The question asks, what is the aircraft's position relative to the station? Well, since it's neither to nor from, it's on a perpendicular line, the 120 degree radial or the 300 degree radial. Since the needle is deflected to the left, that's telling us that the 030 degree radial is to the left or to the west of the aircraft's position. The only choice that makes sense is southeast. That places the aircraft on the 120 degree radial, which extends from the station outward in the direction of southeast. So answer choice southeast is correct. Those are the only two references specifically to figure 29 by itself, not in conjunction with another figure. Let's take a look at figure 30. Figure 30 shows us movable card ADF indications. Here's a question. Let's look at figure 30, illustration number 1. What outbound bearing is the aircraft crossing? See the needle pointing to the station? If you fly a bearing of 210, that'll take you to the station. So the aircraft is on the 210 bearing to the station. However, the question is asking you, what outbound bearing is the aircraft crossing? It's crossing the 210 bearing to the station. The outbound bearing, therefore, is 030. That's the correct answer choice. Which ADF indication represents the aircraft tracking to the station with a right crosswind? A right crosswind, the aircraft is flying to a station, and the crosswind from the right is causing the aircraft to weather vane into the wind. So the aircraft's heading is actually pointing over to the right of the of where it's going. So the heading is offset to the right of its track. If it's going to a station, if there were no wind and the aircraft were tracking to a station directly and no wind, the needle would be right on the nose. If the airplane is holding a right wind correction angle, where do you think the needle is going to be with relation to the nose of the airplane? If the airplane turns to the right to establish a right wind correction angle, the ADF indicator is going to continue to point to the station, which is no longer lined up with the nose of the airplane. Relative to the nose of the airplane now, that station is over to the left. So choice 4 would be the correct answer. Choice 4 is the correct answer. Let's keep looking at this figure. Let's look at illustration number 3. What is the magnetic bearing from the station? Well, the needle points to the station. Looks like it's just shy of 300 degrees. So the magnetic bearing to the station is about 295, maybe. So what's the reciprocal of 295? Look at the tail of the needle. 115 degrees is your bearing from the station. Here's my favorite question in this whole group. Look at illustration 2. Determine the approximate heading to intercept the 180 bearing to the station. So in other words, where would you point the airplane in order to intercept or cross the 180 bearing to the station, after which time, of course, you would turn and establish yourself on that bearing if you're taking it to the station. If you continued on your present heading, where is the needle going to swing? You're flying to the north. The station is to your 8 o'clock position. As you go further and further where you're going, the needle is going to continue to swing to the left. So if you do nothing, you're going to intercept the 180 bearing. You won't be taking it to the station, but you'll certainly intercept it. You'll fly right past it pretty quickly. So you know you have to turn to the left. So if you turned to a heading of 180 and the needle pointed to the right slightly, you would say, I'm going to take whatever the needle deflection is and double that for my intercept angle. So I'm flying 180, the needle is reading 190, that's 10 degrees, I'll double my heading of 180, I'll go to 200 degrees. A 200 degree heading will eventually intercept that bearing in a no wind condition. So the closest answer to 200 is 220. Two more questions. Let's look at illustration 2. Same one we're looking at. What magnetic bearing should you use to fly to the station? What is your bearing to the station right now? It's 190 degrees, right? So, if you turn to 190, you will be flying to the station on the 190 bearing to the station. So what magnetic bearing should the pilot use to fly to the station right now? 190 degrees. And finally, the easiest question of them all. Look at illustration 1, determine the magnetic bearing to the station. The needle points to the station. The compass card is indicating 210 degrees. That is the magnetic bearing to the station. Let's look at figure 31. Figure 31 shows us fixed card ADFs. So all we're getting is relative bearing information. The needle simply points to the station. The nose of the airplane is indicating zero. All we have on fixed card ADFs is relative bearing. We need heading information in order to determine what bearing to or from we are on. Let's look at some of the questions. Got two questions here regarding figure 31. One question says, refer to figure 31, illustration 1. The relative bearing to the station is... The relative bearing to the station is the bearing relative to the nose of the airplane, and that's 315 degrees. And then the other question is, It gives you the magnetic bearing to the station, and it wants you to figure out the magnetic heading. This is with reference to illustration 8. If the magnetic bearing to the station is 135, the magnetic heading is, well, you remember that formula? Magnetic bearing equals relative bearing plus magnetic heading. The magnetic bearing to the station is 135. That equals the relative bearing of illustration 8, which is 135 degrees. Relative bearing is 135. 135 plus what is 135? 135 plus 0 is 135, right? Well, one of the answer choices is 360 degrees. Ready to move on to figure 32? Figure 32 is an excerpt from the airport facility directory for Coeur d'Alene. There are three questions that refer to figure 32. All of them also refer to figure 23, which was a sectional chart we looked at earlier that had Coeur d'Alene on it. You don't need to know what figure 23 has on it. All you need to know is to read the question and look at figure 32. The question is, at Coeur d'Alene, which frequency should be used as a common traffic advisory frequency to self-announce position and intentions? Well, that's the frequency that's used by aircraft operating in and out of Coeur d'Alene. It's on the sectional chart. It's also in the airport facility directory. Here's where to look. See under the bold print in the middle of the page, it says Weather Data Services. Right underneath that, it says Communications, CTAF Unicom 122.8. The second question reads pretty much the same way. It asks at Coeur d'Alene what frequency should be used as a common traffic advisory frequency. And the third question asks what is the correct UNICOM frequency to be used at Coeur d'Alene to request fuel. It's 122.8. The UNICOM frequency is common traffic advisory frequency. It is the frequency that's used to self-announce your position. It's the frequency used to monitor traffic. And it's the frequency used to request fuel. 122.8. UNICOM frequency, common traffic advisory frequency. It's the same thing. When is it different? It's different when you have an operating control tower. In that case, in an airport with an operating control tower, the UNICOM frequency is 122.95. Let's look at figure 33 and 34. I found four questions pertaining to figures 33 and 34. The first asks, what's the maximum amount of baggage that can be carried when the airplane is loaded as follows, and it gives you the loading parameters. The second one asks you to determine if the weight and balance is within limits. The third asks you which action can adjust the airplane's weight to maximum gross weight and CG limits for takeoff. And the fourth one asks you about a weight shift problem, that when you land, a 180-pound passenger departs the airplane, and a rear passenger of 204 pounds moves to the front passenger position. What effect does this have on the CG if the airplane weighed 2,690 pounds and the moment was 2,260 just prior to the passenger transfer? Well, that problem requires you to do two weight and balance problems. You do one weight and balance problem with the given parameters, and then the second one you do with the weight shift problem, and you'd find that the CG did move forward approximately 3 inches. Let's do one of these problems. There's two ways of doing the problem. You can go to figure 34 and look at the moment limit versus weight to determine whether it's in limits, or you can simply do the weight and balance using a calculator that has a memory function, and I'll talk you through doing one. We'll just pick one of these. Determine if the airplane weight and balance is within limits. They're giving you the weight of the occupants, fuel, and baggage. They give you the empty weight of the airplane at 2,015 pounds. They don't give you the arm of the empty airplane. They do give you the moment, which is 1554.00. In order to do this expeditiously with a calculator, you need to get the arm of the airplane. So the way you do that is you take 1554 and you multiply it times 100, and you get 155,400. Divide that by 2015, you get the empty arm of the airplane of 77.12. You need that if you're going to do this calculator method. The way you do this is you clear your calculator, you clear the memory, and you would take the basic empty weight of the airplane, 2015 times 77.12, and you would just press the add memory key. You just threw that into memory, okay? And you go down the list and see what they want you to have. Front seat occupants, 415 pounds, 415 times, what's the arm of the front seat passengers? The arm is 85. Times 85, enter into memory. Then you take the rear seat occupants, 110 times 121, that's the arm of the rear seat, 121, add that into memory. All I did is hitting the M plus key. Okay, I haven't done anything else except what I'm telling you that I'm doing. Fuel main tanks, 44 gallons. Well, how many pounds is 44 gallons? 44 gallons times 6 pounds per gallon? The main wing tank's usable fuel table happens to have a value of 44 gallons, and it's giving you a weight of 264 pounds, right? So, 264 times the arm, 75, 75 plus memory. That's it. And then we go, aux tanks, 19 gallons. Is there a... Yes, there's a value for 19 gallons, 114 pounds. 114 times 94, that's the arm of the aux tanks, 94, plus memory. And baggage is 32 pounds. Baggage or fifth seat occupant, see? So, 32 times 140, enter memory. Okay, I've just inputted the basic empty weight, the front, rear occupants, the fuel, the baggage into the calculator. Now I'm going to press the clear button. Whatever I added to the memory is still there, but the calculator is now cleared for me to do the weight. So now we're going to add up all the weights. Here we go. Empty weight, 2015 plus 415, 415 plus 110, 110 plus 44 gallons, which is 264, 264 plus aux tanks, 19 gallons, 114, 114 plus baggage, 32, 32 plus. My weight is 2,950 pounds. That's my maximum allowable takeoff weight. Great. 2,950 pounds. Clear. The memory has not been cleared. I still have that number in the memory. I'm going to now recall that number, and I'm going to take that number when it appears on the screen and divide it by the weight I just came up with. So I write down my weight, 2,950. Now I clear the calculator, leave the stuff in the memory, and I'm going to press Recall Memory, the RM button. Recall Memory, there's a great big number there, 238977.8. I'm going to press divided by, and I'm going to enter 2950, 2950, hit equals, and my answer is 81.00. That's my center of gravity. Now I look at my forward and aft limit. My forward limit is 82, my aft limit is 84, so I am forward of my forward limit. I am 1 inch forward of my forward limit. So the weight is within limits, and the CG is out of limits. By the way, the other two answer choices both indicate that the airplane is 19 pounds overweight. So by elimination, we know what the correct answer is. But by doing the problem this way, I'm showing you the practical, real-life application of doing these problems. You don't need to go to the figure 34 and use the moments that they give you. You can just add the weights times the arms, track of all of those numbers as they go into the memory of the calculator, and then divide that total number by the total weight of the airplane, and you'll come up with your CG. The final question is, which action can adjust the airplane's weight to maximum gross weight and CG within limits for takeoff? So they give you some items here. The front seat is 425, the rear seat is 300, and the main fuel tanks are 44 pounds. 425 pounds in the front seat, 300 pounds in the rear. Wow. That is pretty heavy. Let's run those weights. take the empty weight of the airplane, 2015 pounds, add that to 425, add that to 300, add that to 44 gallons is 264 pounds, 264 plus, any baggage? Nope. 3,004 pounds, 3004. Boy, that's over 2950. Let's subtract 2,950 to see how far over we are. We are 54 pounds over. 54 pounds. How much fuel is 54 pounds? Divided by 6 pounds per gallon, that's 9 gallons of fuel. One of the answer choices is drain 9 gallons of fuel. Let's move on to figure 35. Unless, do you want to do that weight shift problem? You know, the weight shift problem where the CG moved forward approximately 3 inches? The way you would do that is exactly the way we just did the previous problem. You add up all the weights, you multiply them times the arms, and you get a total moment. And then when the passenger departed the airplane, you subtract 180 pounds from your original weight, which was 2690. Now your weight is down to 2510, but you also have to subtract the moment change from the loss of a 180-pound passenger. So the arm of that passenger was 85, so you have to subtract 180 times 85, which is 15,300 pound inches. You also have to subtract the weight of the rear seat passenger, which was 204 pounds times 121. And then you add that same person's weight, 204 pounds times 85, to get a new moment. So that is a beautiful problem because it takes you through what would actually happen when a person is removed from a station. The weight is removed and the moment is removed. Now you have a new set of figures. And then if a person moves from one seat to the other, you have to remove their weight and remove their moment from where they were, and then re-add the new moment. The weight is going to be the same, but re-add the new moment because the arm has changed. The CG moves forward approximately 3 inches. There's two things you need to remember here. One, the total weight of the aircraft, the maximum gross weight of the airplane, for this figure is 2,300 pounds. That's the maximum gross weight of the airplane for the normal category. The max amount of weight that this airplane can be and still remain in the utility category is 2,000 pounds. So anything over 2,000 pounds, the airplane is now in the normal category. 2,000 pounds or less, it's in the utility category, providing the moment is within the utility envelope. The other thing you need to know about this is that the weight of the airplane does not include the weight of the oil. Well, guess what? For each and every question that you're going to get, the oil is 8 quarts. That's 15 pounds. So if you just remember the oil is going to, you have to add 15 pounds when you do the oil, it's not included in the empty weight of the airplane. Every one of these problems give you the empty weight of the airplane. Let's take a look at a couple of them and just keep in mind the gross weight of the airplane is 2,300 pounds and the weight of the oil is not included, so we have to add 15 pounds. One question says, what's the maximum amount of baggage that can be loaded on board the airplane for the CG to remain within the moment envelope? Well, what they're really looking for is how much baggage can you put on the airplane, because it will be within limits. So we take the empty weight of the airplane, 1350. Now, I've got a little calculator here, and as I'm talking, I'm punching the numbers into the calculator, and I'm looking at the question, and I'm reading the question. It says, empty weight is 1,350 pounds. Now, I'm not going to do the moments for this particular example, because I don't need to. Here's why. 1,350 plus pilot and front passenger, 250, plus rear passenger, 400, plus baggage. Well, they're asking how much baggage can you load on board the airplane, okay? Fuel, 30 gallons. Well, 30 gallons of fuel is 6 pounds per gallon, is 180 pounds, plus oil is 8 quarts, 15 pounds. Enter. 2,195 pounds without baggage. The gross weight of the airplane is 2,300 pounds. So if I find the difference between the weights that they gave me, 2,195 and 2,300, I get a total of 105 pounds difference. All of my answer choices are 105 pounds or more. Since 105 pounds is the most amount of baggage I can take, the other answer choices are greater than 105 pounds. That's the answer I'm going for. That is the correct answer. There are other problems that require you to determine the moment of the airplane. There's even one that says, what is the moment and the aircraft category? Let's do one of those, okay? Calculate the moment of the airplane and determine which category is applicable. The difference between the graph method and the table method is the graph method is not giving you the arms. You have to look the moments up on the graph method, so it's a little bit more involved. It's a little slower to work if you're using a calculator, but it's not a big deal. Let's do it. In these problems, we have to plot the moment. The question gives you the weight, and in this case, for the empty weight of the airplane, it does give you the moment, and it's already been divided by 1,000. And the table, the moment table, is already divided by 1,000 also, 1,000 pound inches. So let's do this problem. I'm going to add up the total weights, okay? The empty weight of the airplane is 1,350 pounds, plus the pilot and front passenger is 310 pounds, plus the rear passengers are 96 pounds, plus the fuel is 38 gallons. Well, 38 gallons times 6 pounds per gallon is 228 pounds, plus oil is 15 pounds. Remember, you have to add oil on all of these problems. So I get 1,999 pounds. All right, the weight of my airplane, I don't know what the moment is, but the weight is 1,999 pounds. So that puts me conceivably within the utility category. I don't know until I plot my moment where my line falls, because I don't know what the center of gravity is, the aircraft loaded moment in this case. So we have to determine that. We do that by going to the graphs. Now, if the manufacturer just gave us the arm, we could just take the weights, multiply them times the arm, and we'll come up with these moments, which we could then divide by the weight and come up with a center of gravity and see where it falls in the table. But this manufacturer does not give us the arms. We have to go to the loading graph and derive them. And then once we derive them, we have to add them up. So it's kind of a tedious process. They give you the moment / 100 of the airplane. The pilot and front passenger, 310 pounds. We have to go to the graph. So you enter the graph by going up the diagonal line where it says pilot and front passenger, and you go up that line as far as you need to go for a weight of 310 pounds. At that point, you make a mark on the graph, and you drop it straight down, and you get a moment from the bottom of the graph. If you go up the pilot and front passenger line until it reaches the load weight pounds of about 310, and then drop that straight down, you'll exit the chart on the bottom, and you'll have 11.5 pound inches. So now we have the first number, 11.5, that we can add to our empty weight moment / 1,000 of 51.5. 51.5 plus 11.5 plus the next moment we have to figure out is for the rear passenger. The rear passenger is 96 pounds. The rear passenger line is that long line that says rear passengers on it. So we go along that line until we come up with 96 pounds, which is just a hair under 100, and we drop that straight down, and that comes out to 7.0. So we're going to add 7 to what we already have. And then we take the fuel of 228 pounds. And the 228 pound mark is right on the fuel line right there. We drop that straight down. It comes out of the graph at 11. So we're going to add 11 to our moment. And the oil it's not graphed. It's telling you it's minus 0.2. Don't they make it easy? Minus 0.2. So now I'm going to minus 0.2. 0.2 and come up with a total moment here of 544.3. Come up with a total of 80.8. So when I added all my moments, 51.5, 11.5, 7, 11, and then minus 0.2, I get 80.8 pound inches. My moment is 80.8. So now I go in the bottom graph and I go to 80.8, just under 81, and I bring that up to 1,999 pounds, and the mark is right on the corner of the utility category. It's in the utility category. It's right on the line there. So it's 80.8, utility category. That's my answer. That's my final answer. There's one other question. It works the exact same way. They give you slightly different values. Of course, the basic empty weight is the same. Pilot and front seat passengers are 380, and the fuel is 48 gallons. Oil is, of course, 8 quarts. You work it the same way. What you'll get is 79.2 normal category. There's one other problem which is really fun to work, and it asks you, what is the maximum amount of fuel that can be aboard the airplane on takeoff if loaded as follows? Well, all we need to do is do the weights here. We don't have to mess with the moments. We just do the weights. So the basic empty weight is 1350, so you take 1350 plus pilot and front passenger 340 plus rear passenger 310 plus baggage 45 plus oil, we know how much that is, right? 15 pounds equals 2,060 pounds. Well, my gross weight is 2,300 pounds. So if I take the difference between 2,300 and 2,060, I get a total of 240 pounds. I can carry 240 pounds of fuel. But the problem asks you for the answer in gallons. Well, 6 pounds per gallon, 240 pounds. If I divide 240 by 6, I come up with 40 gallons. I can take 40 gallons of fuel on board the airplane. And that's it for figure 35. I found two questions on figure 36. The question asks, what is the expected fuel consumption for a 1,000 nautical mile flight under the following conditions? It gives you a pressure altitude of 8,000 feet, which you have on the graph. It gives you a temperature of 22 degrees Celsius, which is not really on the graph, but it's pretty high. I mean, standard is 15 degrees Celsius, right? So there's an ISO minus 20, there's a standard, and there's an ISO plus 20. We're going to go to ISO plus 20 because 22 degrees Celsius is that's pretty high temperature. And then the manifold pressure, 20.8 inches. Well, there is a 20.8 inch table on there. So if we go into the chart at 8,000 at 20.8 inches for ISO plus 20, we come up with 11.5 gallons an hour. 11.5 gallons an hour, and what is it telling us here? 1,000 nautical mile flight, wind is calm. What's our airspeed going to be? Wind is calm. True airspeed is going to be 164 knots. So we take a 1,000 nautical mile flight, take our calculator and take 1,000 divided by our true airspeed, which is 164 knots, 164, and then we multiply that times 11.5 gallons an hour, and our answer is 70.1 gallons of fuel. That is the correct answer. The other one asks you, what fuel flow should you expect at 11,000 feet on a standard day with 65% power? There is no table for 11,000, so we have to interpolate. It is a standard day, and it is 65% power. 10,000 foot pressure altitude, standard day, I'm looking at 11.5 gallons per hour. At a 12,000 foot pressure altitude, I'm looking at 10.9 gallons an hour. So I take my trusty calculator and I take 11.5 and I subtract 10.9 and I find the difference is 0.6. I'm going to divide that by 2, and of course the answer is 0.3. So I'm going to add 0.3 to the lower value, or subtract 0.3 from the higher value. 10.9 plus 0.3 is 11.2. So it's 11.2 gallons an hour. There's your answer. Looking at figure 37, the crosswind component graph, there are no questions on the 2005-2006 question bank regarding figure 37. They've appeared on prior tests, and they likely will appear in future tests, but there are no questions regarding the crosswind component graph on this year's question bank. Let's take a look at figure 38. I found two questions regarding figure 38. They both ask, what is the approximate total distance to land over a 50-foot obstacle? In each of these cases, you're given an outside air temperature. One is a hot day, one is a cold day. Pressure altitude, 4,000 feet for the hot day, 8,000 feet for the cold day. We have a headwind component of 10 knots in one case and 20 knots in the other case. What I want to tell you about this graphic, the thing to keep in mind about this graphic is when you enter the graph, you always enter from the outside air temperature line, go up from the outside air temperature. In one case here, it's 90 degrees Fahrenheit. There's 90. You go straight up, and you keep the line going straight up until you reach the pressure altitude level. In this example, they're giving you 4,000 feet of pressure altitude. And then you stop. And now you're going to go horizontally straight out of the chart to the reference line. So you don't do anything until you reach a reference line. And then from the reference line, you do the next parameter. With the case of 2,800 pounds, well, from the reference line, all those weight lines are slanted. So you have to follow the contour of the line until you get to the vertical line that corresponds with the parameter. So for a weight of 2,800 pounds, if we hit the reference line, we would follow down on an angle that keeps us equal distance between those two lines. The funny thing about them are the lines converge. So the further down you go, the closer to the middle you have to wind up. Anyway, you go down the reference line until you reach the vertical parameter, and then you stop. You exit the chart. You go straight across until you hit the next reference line, and then you look for the next parameter. In one example, they give you a headwind component of 10 knots. Well, now the headwind component has a steep downslope, so you follow the downslope to the vertical parameter line that corresponds with the parameter. You follow it down to the vertical parameter line of 10 knots, and then you stop and you move horizontally across to the next reference line. When you reach the next reference line, you look for another parameter. In this case, it's a 50-foot obstacle. So when you go up the 50-foot obstacle line, notice the 50-foot obstacle lines spread out as you get toward the end of the chart. Keep that in mind as you're following it up. So as you follow the chart up, keep it equidistant from the two lines until you get to the final vertical parameter, at which point you can exit the chart and read your answer. So in the example that I gave you, 90 degree Fahrenheit, 4,000 foot pressure altitude, 2,800 pound weight, headwind component of 10 knots, 50 foot obstacle required 1,775 feet. 1,775. You know, it's always interesting to speculate. The weight of the airplanes are pretty similar in the both examples, 2,800 pounds versus 2,600 pounds. But the cold day, 32 Fahrenheit, has a pressure altitude of 8,000 feet. But the temperature is low. And the hot day, 90 Fahrenheit, that I just gave you, has a pressure altitude of 4,000 feet. Which one do you think will take less distance? Hot day, 4,000 foot pressure altitude, or the cold day with 8,000 feet pressure altitude? Remember our discussion on performance? What one factor really affects performance more than anything? If you can say more than anything, it's going to be the temperature. The increase in temperature has a dramatic effect on performance. In this case, where we had the 8,000 foot pressure altitude with 32 degree Fahrenheit, the distance to land over the 50 foot obstacle was only 1,400 feet. versus 1,775 feet at the higher temperature. Figure 39 is a landing distance table. I couldn't find any questions on the current knowledge bank for this particular landing distance table. Well, the thing to keep in mind about this graphic is the notes. The fact that there may be a headwind will cause you to decrease the distance by 10% for each 4 knots of headwind. You would have to increase the distance by 10% for each 60-degree temperature increase above standard. And then for operations on a dry grass runway, you'd increase the distances, both ground roll and total, to clear 50-foot obstacle by 20% of the total to clear 50-foot obstacle figure. So this is a funny table. They give you very little information, and they give you a lot of conditions. And I'm not surprised that a question from this figure was not on the test. But if there were a figure on the test, the thing to look out for are the notes. Look very carefully if we're talking about any headwind in the example. Look very carefully what the temperature is. And then finally, if the question involves anything other than a hard surface runway, if it's a grass runway, we have to increase the distances. So those are the gotcha items on this innocuous-looking landing distance table that has those three notes in fine print. Beware of the details. There was no reference to figure 39 for the 2005-2006 knowledge bank. Figure 41